The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
I'm delighted now we're joined by the author of one of the most popular books to have come out of Britain in the last year, How to Be Right in a World Gone Wrong. We're joined by James O'Brien, who, of course, is the award-winning radio presenter from LBC Radio. James, thank you very much for taking the time with us. The book very much focuses on the people that you interact with on a daily basis. One of the big topics which is of great interest to us here in Ireland is Brexit. Can I ask today, how many of your listeners were interested in talking to you about the Tory leadership election, which, of course, has such a significant impact on the type of Brexit you're going to get?
It certainly made the phones ring, although I did note I'd come on air at 10 o'clock in the morning and I noted at 10 to 11 that we'd only actually heard three names, one of which wasn't actually present at the debate on Channel 4. So although there is a high level of interest, it's not necessarily interest that Sajid Javid or Jeremy Hunt or even Michael Gove would have been particularly encouraged by. All the talk seems to be about Rory Stewart, the insurgent, and Boris Johnson, whose admirers seem to have boxed themselves into a corner while they simultaneously admire him for being plain speaking and close their eyes and look the other way while he refuses to do any speaking at all.
Plain speaking. A lot of us would regard him on this side of the world as a man who speaks with forked tongue on a regular basis. That you never know what lie he's going to come up with next. How come the British people, the people who listen to your programme, that a certain number of them seem to love this guy?
It's a touch of the Trumps, I suppose. I mean, there is charisma there, for want of a better word. He's funny. He's fluent. He's a good speaker. He makes people laugh. But I to be a little bit more serious, I suspect that he has positioned himself in these ongoing culture wars on the side of people who feel that, you know, ethnicity, sexuality, even gender are issues which people should be judged by, the notion of equality, treating everybody the same. Whether he feels this in his bones or not, or whether he just very cynically knows how to make the right noises to seduce people who do feel it in their bones. Johnson, well, for his entire career, actually, but particularly in the very recent past, he's been going after that constituency to great effect. And if you're in that constituency, then you'll forgive anything. Like when Trump said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose a single vote, so Johnson can duck any form of scrutiny or accountability while still trying to sell himself as the plain-speaking candidate. The people that like him will let him get away with anything, as we're seeing.
What's driving the Brexit conversation at present, though? Is it still all of those issues that perhaps were relevant to the vote in 2016, or has it now become almost a bit of pig iron among some people, is that even if it's pointed out to them that economically it's a catastrophic outcome for Britain, that you can't deal with the issue of Ireland without the backstop, that the pig iron means, no, we voted for it and we won't be stopped getting what we wanted?
It's even worse than that, Matt. They'll claim now that they actually voted consciously for economic harm. And they'll sort of cheerlead for people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, who has said it might take 50 years before we're on an even keel. People are now claiming that they consciously voted for all of the things that the losing side predicted. There have been many moments over the last 3 years where I've thought things can't get any worse, and I've given up thinking that, because every time you do, they do get worse. But what you have now is prominent politicians, cabinet-level politicians, not just your Farages and your kind of pantomime toffs on the backbenches, but they are now claiming in public, they are saying, Andrea Leadsom did it the other day, of course people knew that there were going to be job losses, of course people knew that there was going to be economic harm, because the Remain campaign made that clear, because David Cameron and George Osborne and others made it clear that there would be job losses and economic harm. So certainly for the first time in my political memory, you have the side that won claiming that people voted for them because they actually believed the arguments of the side that lost. And if you're trying to unpick any sort of rationality or logic from that scenario, then, well, you're a better man than me, because I can't.
Of course, when we had Theresa May's failed deals recently before she was ejected, an awful lot was brought up about the backstop and the Irish border. Now, how many of your listeners actually give a damn, do you reckon, about the Irish situation? How angry did it make them that Theresa May was trying to put a deal in place that involved the backstop?
Well, there's two questions there. I mean, everybody who understands it can't be angry. can they? But everybody who's angry doesn't understand it, and there are plenty of people who don't understand it. Again, Sajid Javid this morning has been talking about how the technology is there to do it. He's previously said, well, we'll just give Ireland all the money that they need to impose the infrastructure. So if someone like that, you know, the Home Secretary can still fail to understand that the European Union negotiates as a bloc. It doesn't matter what you go to Dublin and say, it will still have to be approved by the 27 member countries. And this idea that you can have two regulatory frameworks on two sides of an invisible border without actually having anything in place to enforce or impose the conflicting regulatory frameworks. I mean, it has always seemed to me so unerringly simple to understand that I haven't really understood why it's even been controversial. And then the other element of this, of the backstop argument, is, of course, the people telling us it's really, really easy to fix, the people telling us that there are technological solutions or alternative arrangements or whatever ludicrous confection they've come up with today, are exactly the same people who object furiously to the idea that, OK, then it's really easy to fix, so we'll just put this backstop in place until you fixed it. So they then say, well, you can't do that because then it will be indefinite. And I say, well, it won't be indefinite because you've just told us that it's really easy to fix. So you should really be at the front of the queue of the people who don't care about the backstop, because the thing that the backstop is there to protect against is the thing that you're saying is really, really easy to deliver. So again, the madness is absolutely all engulfing. It's the same people objecting to the backstop that are saying we've got a really simple solution to the backstop, but it goes to a different school.
In your book, How to Be Right in a World Gone Wrong, you distinguish, or you emphasise the importance of distinguishing between people who tell lies for personal gain and people who believe them for personal reasons.
Yes.
Just tell me a little bit more about that.
It works as a slogan, actually. It would be contempt for the con men, compassion for the conned. If there's 100 people in a room and someone bursts through the door at the back of the room and shouts fire, or shouts there's a lion coming. Now, it took me a while to get my head around this, but if 52 people in that room run for the fire escape without having any idea what's on the other side of the fire escape, and 48 people in that room go and check. They go and see, is there really a lion coming? Is there really a fire? And it turns out that there isn't. The 52 people who ran for that door are not stupid. They're not, you know, racist or uneducated or economically left behind or any of those things. They're just frightened, justifiably frightened. And the justification for their fear is built upon the credibility of the person who's shouted fire. And if the person shouting fire is a former mayor of London or a former education secretary, or, you know, in the case of Nigel Farage, someone that's on Question Time more often pretty much than David Dimbleby was, you can't get cross with 52 people for thinking, well, there must be something in it, because look at the credibility, for want of a better word, of the people who've just shouted it. So I get cross with Gove and Johnson and Farage, and I get cross with some of the people that have run for the fire
escape. Yeah, because I was just about to ask, because presumably, yeah, once they realise, well, actually, we've been duped, there isn't a fire, do they not then turn instead and focus their attention on the people who have lied to them and ask themselves, why have they been lying to us?
Hopefully they will, and many people are. But, I mean, the simplicity of my analogy is a flaw here, because it's not just one bloke shouting fire in a room. It's 30, 40 years of concentrated effort that the media, for various reasons, most of them commercial rather than political or ideological, have put into portraying the European Union as not just being a sort of bureaucratic obstacle, but as being somehow opposed to British interests. So once you've sown that seed of this institution actually being our enemy, then evidence becomes less and less relevant to the feelings, to the emotional response. So these phrases that when I was doing this job 5 years ago, I used to laugh at the text that would come in talking about the Fourth Reich or the EUSSR, I now realise that was the tip of an iceberg. That would be the extreme fringe of a constituency that really did believe that the European Union was opposed to our national interests. And that's really hard to unpick. And when you consider that it's gone more or less unchallenged by successive governments for over 30 years, you simultaneously have an enormous frustration with people who won't go and have an actual look at the facts, but a degree of sympathy for the reasons why they wouldn't even contemplate going to look at the facts. It's fight or flight, isn't it? And the enemy is so real in their minds that they're not going to put in the necessary effort to establish the fact that the enemy doesn't, it's not just not as bad as they thought it was, it doesn't actually exist at all.
You're very interesting in the book on the right to free speech and also how some people who demand it actually want free speech as long as it's free from scrutiny. Yes. But do you have any regret that you on your programme, like many others, and this is something I would say even myself here on this programme, for putting people on air thinking they're only fringe, they're not really representative, we'll hear them out because we believe in free speech, and then suddenly realise, oh my God, the lies they are telling are actually having a really bad impact.
Not personally on my programme, but certainly station, you know, I've worked on Newsnight at the BBC, and the platform I have on LBC is a very broad church, and there is a huge problem with people not being picked up on demonstrable facts. This conflation of opinion with fact has been incredibly dangerous. It's not confined to the modern political landscape. You look at, I think most obviously, probably climate change and certainly the MMR vaccines, and this weird obsession with balance and equivalence means that you're basically sitting down with, to your left is 97% of the world's scientific consensus, and to your right is some weird blogger with a book to sell, and they get treated with equal weight, they get treated with equal respect. And then in the context of a phone-in, I'm at great pains whenever somebody says something that I know not to be true, I will pick them up on it. But they get very cross because they think that they're being talked over or interrupted. But it took me a while to have the confidence to say, look, I don't care how cross you get. You can't come on national radio and say things that aren't true. You know, it just, I will interrupt you. I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you finish. You can't say things that aren't true. But without sounding, you know, conceited, It's been a fairly lonely furrow to plough over the last few years. That,
but how much of it then is down to making sure you have your facts in a row rather than opinion than the person that you're talking to?
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to have your facts, and that's why, unless you know somebody says something that is categorically untrue about, for example, the Lisbon Treaty, has been doing the rounds on the fake news ends of the Facebook pages at the moment. Lots of people ringing me up saying that they know what's actually in the Lisbon Treaty, and in 2021 we're going to have to join the EU army, we're going to have to surrender up all our firstborns for Jean-Claude Juncker's lunch. There's all sorts of extreme claims on a very plausible looking Facebook feed that has been shared, you know, it's like they say, it's halfway around the world, the lie before the truth has got his trousers on. So I do the fact check, and I know it's out there, and I'm ready for that call before it comes in. I mean, look, if I make a mistake, I make a mistake, but I don't think I have yet, because a lot of the stuff that they're coming out with is clearly untrue. WTO terms, we'll be fine on WTO terms. Half the world trades on WTO terms, someone might say. Again, because they've heard someone say it on the telly, they've heard someone say it on the radio. So I say, name one country that currently trades exclusively on what you call WTO terms. One country on the whole planet that has no trade agreement, no trade associations, no trade treaties in place at all. Give us the precedent, that the example that you can use now to justify your faith that this would be a good or an undangerous thing to do. And of course they can't. And they hate being put on the spot like that.
One final thing, James O'Brien. Where's this all going to end? I mean, could we end up with a nightmare scenario for Ireland, as much as for you and Britain, where we have Boris Johnson as the Tory Prime Minister who is unable to get a different deal with the European Union to the one that Theresa May negotiated, and brings Britain crashing out of the European Union at the end of October, with all of the consequences then for trade, for culture, for the border in this island? Is the worst likely to happen?
I think it's more than possible. I think it's more possible than it has been up to and including this point, and I'll tell you, it's a pretty picture, really, a great illustration of just how mad everything has become in the context of Britain and Brexit. Because the nearest thing I've got to optimism, Matt, is the fact that you've never been able to trust a word that Boris Johnson says. So it may well be that he, within moments of getting into Downing Street, turns around and completely betrays the trust and the support of the people that he's needed to get him into Downing Street. I don't think his ego will allow him to be one of the shortest, if not the shortest lived prime minister in history. And if he doesn't want to be that, then I mean, he's got to either press pause, put it back to the people. If he puts it back to the people, he won't do it with a general election, I don't think. Because unless we've crashed out with no deal, the Tories will be held hostage at the polls by the Brexit Party. So another referendum, which is why perhaps the most significant thing that's happened in British politics so far this week, and it's only Monday, is Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, coming out and calling for his party to now stop faffing about and establish itself as a rallying point for remaining and a second referendum. And that possibly puts a different complexion on things. But in the context of a Johnson premiership, I mean, it's way more than 50-50, but there's that oddly comforting thought that his entire record suggests that he won't have any qualms at all about doing the polar opposite once he's in office of what he promised to do while trying to get into office.
James O'Brien, thank you very much for being with us today. The book is called How to Be Right in a World Gone Wrong.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.